You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections. Join them in the Ivy League of cheese education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host. It's our 14th year here on Heritage Radio Network. Well, I came out to Denver to celebrate the Bolozol Mezcal and Pozole Festival. And of course, our friend Emily Hudo at Radcraft Beer said, you got to meet Greg and Sarah Fetzer at the Emporium Brewery. So I'm here now. I walked in. It was my perfect way to start the day. Spent grain aroma for breakfast. So this is what Denver's like, and we're going to talk more about it, and we get some other friends joining us later who are here to sell their tequila as well. So let's go around the room and introduce ourselves.
Sure. I'm Sarah Fetzer, owner of the Emporium Brewing Company.
Yeah, Greg Fetzer, owner and head brewer of the Emporium.
I will say it's quite a treat to be here. Denver's been really nice to me. I'm mostly an East Coast guy, so everything's a little different. So what's it like, the business climate and beer climate in Denver? I've always heard about Fort Collins. Just tell me about drinking beer in Denver.
Yeah, absolutely. There is absolutely no shortage of beer in Denver, that's for sure. The Craft Brewers Guild kind of labeled Colorado specifically as the state of craft beer, and Denver is absolutely a central hub. A lot of people think of Fort Collins because of New Belgium and stuff like that, but if you're looking for small, more independent breweries, things like that, Denver is the spot. Really leading the charge as far as innovation. You can find anything from sessionability, high alcohol beers, wood age, light lagers. It's been fun to be a part of.
Yeah, just in our neighborhood alone, within 4-block radius, there's 5 of us. So it's a great little area to come down here and do a little brewery tour.
Wow, give a shout out to those other breweries.
Yeah, so Flight Co. Brewing, they opened a month before we did, so they're always kind of been our neighborhood buddies. Berkeley Alley Beer Company is in the alley right behind us, and right around the corner from them is the Grateful Gnome. He's also like a New Jersey style deli, so great sandwiches. And then Call to Arms is probably the longest running one, and they're a few blocks north of us as well.
Great. So let's talk about starting up. Greg, your background in beer and as a brewer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like a lot of people in the beer industry kind of took an interest in home brewing. And we actually went to Colorado State. So we're from Fort Collins. We went there, went to college there. So huge craft brew scene there, obviously. And they were early on the scene. So started home brewing, did that for a while, decided I wanted to quit the desk job, get into it professionally. So we both moved to the West Coast, Oregon coast. And I worked for Rogue out there for a couple of years, started on the lower level packaging, worked my way up, learned it all from the bottom up, came back to Colorado. We always knew we wanted to be back in Colorado, worked for another brewery up to a head brewer position there in Castle Rock. And then 4 years ago from earlier this week, actually, we opened this bad boy.
Yeah, we opened our doors on March 29th, 4 years ago. So two days and 4 years.
Congratulations.
Cheers.
It feels like an accomplishment, doesn't it?
Very much so. Especially, we opened March 2019, and then March 2020, we were shut for COVID. So our first anniversary, we were closed. So
to be able to rock through that, we're very fortunate where we are. We have a very neighborhood model as far as a business model goes. So the Berkeley neighborhood in Denver really kept us afloat during that. We couldn't be happier or more fortunate to be where we are.
Well, let's talk about the beers. You know, do you have a philosophy of beer? I mean, I walk in smelling spent grain in the morning. That says it all for me, right? Right there, I'm like, this is quality. There's something about that.
Yeah, absolutely. What we kind of liked about the name The Emporium when we started is it implies that we'll have a little bit of everything for everybody. And we really wanted to approach it, again, being a neighborhood brewery with a neighborhood model of having sessionable beers, meaning a little lower on the alcohol side, a little bit of touch of finesse, a little more balance in the IPAs, not bitter bombs and stuff like that. Our fruity beers are very balanced, very approachable. So we kind of came from it from sessionability and just kind of making sure that we had a little bit of something for everyone.
Wow, that's great. Well, I'm drinking the rice lager. Let's talk about that. So Emily says that I like rice lagers. I do like rice lagers. You know, what is it about rice that makes this lager so drinkable?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do a decent amount of light lagers. There's something that's fun about that, especially as a brewer. There is very little to hide behind in a light lager. So you can really fine tune kind of your expertise. It takes a lot of finesse to do something simple, easy, clean. If you have one off flavor, you're absolutely going to taste it, especially with a rice lager. A rice lager, essentially the rice that you add, it has about 30% rice. And rice will add basically no flavor. It just adds a little more alcohol, lightens the body, things like that. So really makes it dry, clean, crisp, awesome for the hot weather coming up. And we were fortunate enough to win a bronze at World Beer Cup for this one last year.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah, and how important is that, like World Beer Cup and GABF and the things that the Brewers Association has set up? How important are those to you as a brewer?
Yeah, they're huge. We get solicited to enter several competitions, hundreds a year, but we only do two, and I think a lot of breweries do. It's GABF and then the World Beer Cup. GABF is more of a national competition that everyone enters. The World Beer Cup is a worldwide competition, so you're going up, especially with your German lagers, you're going up against German breweries and things like that. And anywhere, any given year, you're going up against 10,000 to 12,000 different beers. It's really the who's who. It's almost like the Oscars of the beer industry type of a deal, you know?
So, Sarah, when did you get roped into being part of this brewery?
From the beginning, I'd say. We met just after college, and both of our families have their own businesses, and I think that was always kind of a goal of ours. And Greg is so passionate about craft beer and brewing, and he eats, sleeps, drinks craft beer. So we kind of knew that it was something we wanted to do, but we wanted that professional experience first. So I have the marketing and finance background, so I kind of do all the paperwork and, you know, fun behind the scenes things.
Stuff you get no credit for.
Yeah. But it's fun. It's rare, I think, to be able to work with your spouse every day and still love them, as weird as that sounds. But, from the beginning, this is something we knew we wanted to do, and 4 years in, we're still having fun, so it's cool.
Well, it's great. I mean, it's behind the scenes, but, you know, everyone that's you're ordering from and you're paying the bills to, they know when you're doing a good job, right?
I hope so. Yes.
Yeah. We kind of like being the husband-wife team, and we have a couple other partners as well. But what we like about how small we are and everything is we're incredibly hands-on. All the owners are. So every time someone comes in here, they'll see one of our faces. I feel like that's kind of cool and unique from a craft beer and small business perspective too.
Great. Let's talk about your community. Cause, I think that's one thing that stands out about a small family owned brewery.
Absolutely. So we picked Tennyson Street in the Berkeley neighborhood, because it reminds, so Greg and I are both from small Colorado towns. We went to Fort Collins and CSU, and Old Town Fort Collins reminded us a lot of this area that we're in now. And it's cool to see customers walking down the street with their dog or their kids, and you can wave and say, you know, hey, Billy, or say hi to their dog, Abel, and things like that. And then you come in and you know exactly what they want to drink. So it's really what we wanted to do was be a neighborhood spot, and the neighborhood's really rallied behind us for that.
What's your policy on strollers?
They're welcome, and they're a lot on Sundays.
Yeah, keep them close to the table.
Yeah.
That's about all we ask.
Yeah, we also allow dogs, too, so sometimes it can get a little crazy, but they're people's kids, too, so.
So besides the rice lager, what are some beers that are on right now or that you really like that you would want to tell people about?
Yeah, sure. Some of our more popular beers, we have a coffee blonde that we do strictly on nitro through the tap room. So it kind of weirds people out. We don't always have a dark beer on, but that one drinks super dark, even though it is a light beer. Infused with coffee, it pours light, but drinks pretty pretty dark. It's a fun one. And on nitro, it almost drinks like a nitro cold brew. It's a fun beer. And then our staples, Dope IPA, Peace Love and Pale Ale, those are two that are two of our popular. And Peace Love is kind of close to our heart. We do a portion of profits for that beer every month to a new charity. So that one we really try to push and, you know, get people to buy and donate and things like that.
You know, in your career, Greg, you know, I'm in this really nice little brew house, but it's great. Tell us about a couple of the places you worked and maybe one thing that you learned in each as a brewer or about running the operation.
Yeah, I think I probably, in comparison to a lot of other people, took a unique career path, starting at a incredibly large production facility like Rogue, where we were doing 120,000 barrels a year, to Rockyard, where we were doing close to 5,000 to 7,000 barrels a year. And now here we're doing about 500 barrels. We're on pace to hit close to 700 barrels this year with the distribution we picked up. So I've been able to learn kind of the processing techniques from a huge brewery and kind of bring the large production philosophy to a really small place, you know? And I think a lot of that has to do with consistency is huge, especially in large packaging, because with Rogue, if they pick up a dead guy in one spot, pick up a dead guy from the other, it has to taste the exact same or else they're not going to drink it again. So we come with that consistency approach of a large production facility to our teeny tiny little brew house here.
Yeah, and we like to have fun with it. You know, Greg working at Rogue and Rockyard, they had staples that they had to make all the time. And we have our core beers, but we like to have fun with it too. So one of our weird ones that we did, and now it has to come back every summer, is called Selenia. It's a cucumber basil kettle sour. Kind of tastes like cucumber water.
When you said that, you gave me a funny look on your face. Why did you do that?
I mean, cucumber basil in a beer sounds kind of weird.
It's also,
but it's
just
delicious.
A giant pain in the ass to make.
It is. So we do 100 or about 200 pounds of fresh cucumber. So we have to hand peel process it. It takes the four of us here 6 hours in one day to do it. The whole brew house smells like cucumber, which smells delicious. Wildly big hit that we weren't expecting. So it's kind of a fun one, but also a pain in the butt to make every year.
Yeah. That one is fun. We kind of have the ability, and what we like about our size, we have 13 taps, six staples, five staples. So we have a lot of room to play. And I think that's been a lot of fun for me in particular, just because, like Sarah said, coming from the larger production facilities, having to make the same 5 to 6 beers every day, we can play around a lot and experiment with ingredients, find things that the neighborhood likes, what they don't, really listen to what our neighborhood wants.
Wow, it's really great, man. Can you talk about naming your beers? Because I know you've got some fun names.
Yeah, absolutely. We're kind of big movie, music buffs, podcasts, all of that. So other than Peace, Love, and Pale Ale, which is our charity beer, we do everything based off of pop culture references. So Atari's Lantern, our rice lager, is from a Wes Anderson movie, Isle of Dogs. It's a great way for us and our staff to connect with customers. They can take a look at the menu, kind of go over, challenge them on what references they can get, what references they can't. That part we have a lot of fun, and we're small enough and don't distribute outside of the state that we can kind of not have to worry about, you know, a big production company coming after us for having a name.
Right. Yeah, I mean, TV, music, movies, whatever's popular, you know, at this point in time. We just did a movie from the menu. I don't know if you've seen that. It's kind of a chef-y based movie. So we kind of put our brewer spin on it and had fun making the video and stuff for social media. So just kind of having fun with it.
And what was that beer?
That was a Calling Dr. Sunshine, a hazy IPA. Yeah. So, and that's fun. That movie hasn't been out that long, and we're able to churn beers out long enough that our beer names can stay relevant. We can kind of deal with what's in the news, what's popular right now when we do it. So.
Right. Instead of a regular restroom sign on the wall, we have Forrest Gump pointing, you know, to where the restroom is.
Really leaning into the pop culture stuff. It's fun.
Being fun, being silly, having fun.
Anything Forrest Gump is a winner to me. Hey, Hums. Okay. Fresh Hop Fest. I heard that you guys do it. Tell us about a Fresh Hop Fest. And also hops and the hop season here in Colorado, because we're going to talk about ingredients, because you also have a lot of great breweries and a lot of great ingredients.
Yeah. Hops in Colorado specifically have kind of taken off in the last 5 or so years as far as hop farms. There was typically only one, High Wire Hops, and now Billy Goat is a big one in the Montrose area. So fresh hop beers specifically, and when we say fresh hop, we mean they can only be brewed once a year, typically around September, during hop harvest season. And what they do is they cut down the binds with all the fresh hops, pick them straight off the bind, throw them in a cooler, and we brew with them within 24 hours of them being picked. Just try to get the freshest hop humanly possible. So you really can only do that once a year during harvest season. And they're incredibly sought after. Not everyone is able to do them. It takes a lot of strain on your equipment. You have to have the equipment ready at the right time, because there's only one time a year, and harvest always changes, like anything. It's never a set day every single year. It just depends on the seasonality of everything. So we kind of wanted to rally around that idea. And really, especially with some of us being new in the neighborhood at the time, as far as breweries go, we wanted an event that kind of brought all the breweries together, kind of show them that we're more collaborative than competitive. So that's kind of how we started it, is we had all the breweries bring their fresh hop beers to our parking lot for the first year, set up a small stage in the parking lot, and it was huge. Luckily the fire department didn't show up. But yeah, so we've kind of grown that.
Careful what you wish for.
I know. I probably shouldn't
right
be saying
down the
that
street,
out loud.
So.
But now we shut down the street, invite other local Denver breweries, try to keep it as local as we can, but expand it little by little. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun, huge neighborhood hit.
In terms of brewing, just walk us through at your production level, what are the challenges of using fresh hops, and when you're using it, what stage in the brew process?
Yeah, the main challenge with fresh hops is they're whole cone still. So typically nowadays systems are set up to use pelletized hops, which break up really nicely in the boil, the fermenter, and you can just dump them right down the drain, not have to worry about anything getting clogged. With whole cone, it'll clog up the entire system, because we've gotten so used to pelletized hops, systems aren't really made to handle whole cone, so you have to get really creative in that process, just to make sure that you're not getting anything stuck in the heat exchanger, anything like that. The whole cone hops, also coming straight from the farm, haven't had a chance to go through that pelletizing process, where they're heated up, ground up a little bit, so they do come with some live bacteria, bugs, things like that you kind of have to use them hot side, make sure they're getting hot enough to kill everything you don't want, so you don't get an infection in your brewery too.
Wow. Tell me that again. Tell me more. This is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. So it is an incredibly fun process, because we do get the very large majority of our hops come from Hophead Farms in Michigan. And when I say very large majority, it's like 99%. But they do, when they harvest every year, they will basically they'll pick them that night, load them into a bin for us, get them in the freezer until they can schedule a flight, Southwest Freight. And basically, they'll load them Southwest Freight, and in the bottom of the freight airplane, they'll basically freeze. So when we get them, they're perfectly green, lush. They're beautiful. But we go out to the airport. We go out to DIA, pick them up, drive them to the brewery, and brew them with them right that day. They are fresh, less than 24 hours picked. So it's been really fun. It's a really long day. You got to rely on Southwest Freight, which isn't always the easiest thing, you know, shipping problems, but it's worth it. It's worth it for us.
And then when do you drink the beers? How long after they're made? And then what's that first sip of beer like for you with the fresh hops?
Yeah, sure. It's typically for the fresh hop beer, any of our ales, especially when we dry hop them, are anywhere 3 to 4 weeks. Yeah, 3 to 4 weeks, and you can't replicate that flavor any other way. You can use as many hops as you want, as many different kind of hops as you want. Fresh hops, just, it hits different.
Oh, believe me, I know. It's the kind of thing that I would seek out, a fresh hop fest. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, the neighborhood's really rallied around it. We have breweries contacting us who want to be a part of it, so it's pretty cool. Yeah.
I've got a lot more questions for you guys. We actually have some friends here from the Bolzol Festival, a couple tequila maker and his importers, and a mezcal importer. It's a pretty special day in Denver, this great beer and event town. I'm going to give a big shout out to Denver, just how welcoming the community was. And the food component of our event is pozole. And Denver gets pozole, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, you're not wrong about that.
And on the East Coast, there's some great chefs making pozole, but, you know, in the public, you know, consciousness, it doesn't pop out. When you say pozole, a lot of people have to think about it. Out here in Denver, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. It's delicious.
So before they come on, I think we're going to take a break in a few minutes and they'll come on. I'm going to ask you about a couple of the community aspects, like the awesome mural. And what's your hashtag for that?
Portrait. So P-O-U-R, pouring a beer, portrait. So our mural was created by Drew Button, which is an artist in Denver that Greg has worked at previous breweries at Rockyard and Castle Rock that did their label. And when we were opening the brewery, we knew we wanted a mural, but we didn't know a muralist, and we knew Drew. So we asked him, hey, would you want to make our mural? And he was like, I've never done one before. And we were like, well, we've never opened a brewery before, so that's perfect. We showed him the space, we gave him free rein, and he completed that amazing piece of work for us. He also did the Forrest Gump, I Got a Peace sign for us as well. Super talented. He's probably done 15 to 20 other murals now around Denver and the state since then. Super sweet guy. Kind of a nice thing. We still get people sometimes that'll be like, wow, when did you add that? Like, it's always been there. So sometimes people don't see it right away, which I don't know how you couldn't see it because it's huge, but it's a fun piece. You know, he wrote a whole description about what it means, but it's really just kind of doing whatever we want to do with our beer and kind of breaking the mold and the lines behind it and showcasing what we can do.
Well, that's great. If you look at our show photos, there'll be the great mural as our backdrop. Anything else you guys want to say before we invite the other people in?
No, appreciate it, man. We're looking forward to the summer. We got First Friday season coming where we close down the lot, have a bunch of live music. So if you're in the area, especially on First Fridays, we release a new beer every First Friday. Come check us out.
Is that everywhere in Denver? Because we were at the Skylight venue in the Santa Fe Arts District. They also talked about First Friday.
Santa Fe has a big one as well. It's typically a little neighborhood-based, just depending on where you are. Tennyson has a pretty established one. Santa Fe has a very established one. And you'll see them kind of in and out. It's really great opportunities for people to just come out and see what all the small businesses on the street are all about.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for us, too, to showcase a new artist. So our beer is our art, but First Friday art walks are where they originated. And so every month we bring in a new artist and they get to hang their pieces on our wall and we sell them for them. We don't take a commission or anything on it. We just want to get their name out there, and we sell a decent amount for people. So it's really cool. There's music, there's art, there's food, there's drinks. It's just a really fun kind of busy day.
Wow. And let's give a shout out to talk about great women in beer who are behind it, behind the scenes. Emily Huto, great job, Red Craft Beer. You want to give her a shout out, Sarah?
Yes, I would love to give Emily Huto a shout out. You've been so helpful for us, and we love working with you. You're the best.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We're back in a few minutes here on Beer Sessions Radio. We're out here in Denver, Colorado. All right.
Coming this spring, we're working on something big for opening soon.
Opening a restaurant can sometimes take months or even years.
So I have this one consulting client that's been 3 months away from opening for the past year.
And I had a calendar reminder show up today, and the reminder was that our goal was to open tomorrow.
But this spring, you'll be able to hear it in just a few hours.
On March 30th, he had passed away, and then on March 31st, he had come back to life. And then on April 2nd, he had passed away again. And I was like, okay, my regards to the family. I don't even know how to receive this information.
So tune in as we follow one of Brooklyn's best and brightest young chefs and restaurateurs on their journey from start to open doors.
Alex, you need to put more money in. We're out. We can't pay anybody.
He is the bratwurst. Oh my God, that guy.
It's The Build.
Subscribe to Opening Soon from Heritage Radio Network, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections.
It feels like a gift to be able to give this gift to people, because I know that from my own experiences, I know how valuable, consolidated, incredible training resources are.
They offer an in-depth education on all things cheese, as well as an active network for peer support and career development.
You can pop over to the Quad, which is our social networking and engagement app. And so that's a really fun and dynamic aspect of Cheese State University.
Cheese State's three-part course is designed for seasoned pros and entry-level mongers alike, and covers all the skills one needs to perform on the cheese counter.
The structure of Cheese State University is all based on the Cheese State University Field Guide. And that is a three-volume resource. It's all digital, online.
At the end of the course, students will be ready to ace the field guide assessment and earn their Cheese State Scholar Certificate.
Another resource is a video series where we tackle sort of like these thornier questions that you can get on the cheese counter, like what is rennet and like why is this cheese so expensive and can pregnant people even eat cheese?
At Cheese State, you're among experts, you're among scholars, you're among cheese lovers, and most importantly, you are a monger. Join them in the Ivy League of Cheese Education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. This is part two of our Denver episode. We're at the Emporium Brewery in Berkeley area of Denver. And I just was talking with Sarah and Greg Fetzer. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
So we are here for the Bolazol Mezcal and Pozole Festival. So some of the mezcal and tequila folks came by as well. And it's such a pleasure to be with them. And we're going to introduce them. But first, we're going to ask them what they're drinking. So everyone say their name, where you're from, and what beer you're drinking. And the taproom guy is going to give you the right name of the beer. So let's go with Eduardo.
Hey, hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Well, my name is Eduardo. I am a partner of Oaxaca Mezcal. I'm very happy to be in the Bolzole again and in this fantastic city. What a show. It was fantastic. And always my beer of choice is IPA. This time it's a hazy IPA, East Coast style. I don't get the name, but it's fantastic.
It's called Calling Dr. Sunshine.
And that's the one we were talking about, right, Greg?
Yep, exactly, the menu reference.
All right, and now Mike.
How are you guys? My name is Mike Moreno. I have a couple different businesses, actually. So I own Moreno's Liquors and Ositos Tap in Chicago. But I am here specifically to work with my good friends from Amate Peña with my business, MM Imports. And yeah, I am currently drinking a lovely blonde coffee ale, right?
Yeah, so it's a nitro coffee blonde called Conditions of My Parole.
And that's another cool name.
Yeah, absolutely. Pussifer reference. So if you're familiar with Tool, Perfect Circle, Pussifer, same lead singer.
Yeah, I'm not, but it's okay. And now our friend from the tequila place himself.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us. My name is Alberto. I'm the tequila producer of Amate Peña Tequila. And yes, thank you for the event. This is amazing. It was amazing, the bowl of sole. And now I'm drinking double oak, porter style.
Yeah, so it's a rye barrel-aged Baltic porter.
Nice. Yeah. All time I prefer this stuff. I love this.
It's great. It's fun to drink beer with my mezcal and tequila friends. And Roman.
I am Roman. I'm the importer of Amatitania tequila. I'm here today drinking blackberry smoke. It's a nice fruity, you know, beer for the morning time. Well, I guess my morning, because we were at the fantastic Bowl of Zole show last night. Yeah. Hanging out at the after parties as well. So, you know, late night, late morning, you know, that kind of day today.
I tell you, we were welcomed in Denver, and, you know, there's such a great community here. Thanks, Greg and Sarah, for hosting us at Emporium, a really great beer bar and brewery. So Bowl of Zole, I want to talk to you guys about what you guys do, because, you know, you're going to be, all of you are going to be at a couple different events with us. We're in Denver, you're going to be in Boston 2 weeks, you're going to be in New York City. We're going to start with Eduardo, because last time I saw him, I said, Eduardo, in the world of Bowl of Zole, you are one of the originals, because you were there at the first one, so I've kind of bonded with you. It's like, you know, I was born out of the womb into mezcal and tequila, and I saw Eduardo.
Yeah, well, you know, pozole certainly is one of more Mexican soups than you can find in a lot of places, more in the United States. It's certainly incredible to see how much all these restaurants that you invite to your shows get creativity. Cheers. I get a creativity, and you know, I get pozoles that I never have in my life in Mexico, and oh my God, I really like those. But with this creativity, they add seafood. They add so much ingredients. Yesterday was a neighbor of guy to mix Chinese food with the pozole. It was incredible, the sparkling flavors, really nice. Or our friends of La Diabla, they just bring the pozole to another level. You know, this is incredible when a big chef is able to make a fantastic pozole. And also you can add a little bit of a great tequila, like my brother here is doing, or a great mezcal. Man, you are going certainly in the perfect pairing. So not only one of the originals, but I will be certainly one that I will never leave you guys. I will be always there for sure.
Great. That's a great intro. Oaxaca, spelled Wahaka, mezcal, Eduardo. And the pozole he had was from Hop Alley, which does do like a Chinese Yunnan flavors. And Mike, the reason I wanted you guys here is because you're a good talker. You're into sales. But, you know, why mezcal? Why tequila? And tell us what you do, because, you know, you're in Colorado.
Yeah. Why mezcal and why tequila? That's an excellent question. First of all, there is nothing as complex or as unique as mezcal and tequila. I mean, when you're talking about the processes, talk about and think about terroir. Now you're thinking about wine. You know, a lot of people, when they think about spirits, they don't assume terroir, because most of them are just utilizing, you know, whatever corn they might get from their local distributors, so on and so forth. But what we're doing here is a passion project. And that's why I love sitting here with Eduardo, a good friend of mine, and we're with Alberto, who's, you know, they're both doing really unique things in various different regions of Mexico. But they have fantastic products because they're controlling everything all the way from the agaves down to the distillation process. The slow cooking process that we're doing is going to change the flavor profiles. The wild fermentation, that's really unique. You know, so tequila and mezcal is truly a passion of mine. It's things that I love. Now to go into kind of what I do, or we're taking a quick photo. So what I do and you know, and why I'm here, obviously, you know, I've had a liquor store in Chicago for years, 46 years in May this year. We're very excited about our anniversary. I opened up a speakeasy, but something that I really had wanted to work on and focused heavily in within the last couple of years, and have had actually since 2015, started as a marketing firm. But then I was like, you know what, there's so much more I could offer and there's so much more we could do with this. Is I started working on bringing unique products into the markets. So I started in Illinois. We just expanded into Colorado, got connected with, you know, with now I'd consider a good friend, Roman, who was able to help me get some amazing products. And Amatitania was just such a wonderful tequila. And, you know, it's fun to kind of see how we're able to connect with people. I was down in Mexico last year. I met Roman's wonderful father over at Old Town Tequila, and then Alberto. And I felt like Alberto was actually more excited to see me than I was to go down there. He was like, oh, you got to see this. He was taking all these photos. He showed me a Matiteña. And I said, this is such a good tequila. And that is when I was like, I need to get involved.
And what was a favorite chef's pozole you had last night at Bolazole?
Oh, man. There was a pozole I had outside in the corner. I wish I remember the name.
Chef Oscar Padilla. He's known as Gaucho. He's opening a new place. He worked at one of the other restaurants before.
Yes, that pozole was absolutely killer. I loved how the flavor profiles, the little bit of like smokiness and texture that he did with the meat. That was really good.
It was so wild riding to Denver for the first time and doing the festival. And you guys who have been with us in other cities and, you know, we're meeting the Denver breweries and chefs, and it's just a great experience. Roman, we're going to end up with Alberto because his product is so special. But intro to you, because, again, you're someone that grew up in the industry. Tell us about Roman, who you are, and, you know, why you're here with me.
Oh, man. I don't even know where to begin with myself, I guess. You know, I've always loved agave products and, you know, doing fun, different things. And it's kind of like, you know, basically I can kind of like bookend what Mike was saying, the same exact things about why agave is special. I got into importing a couple of years ago. Matiteña was my very first project, and kind of like talking to Alberto about it was why I did get into importing. It was, you know, I still remember when he sent me up these little samples. I still have one of the bottles left, you know. And, you know, what thing we want and what we like and all that good stuff.
Well, go back with you. So you grew up in the industry. So tell us, there's a family business. Tell us about that, because I've never been there in San Diego.
Well, you need to visit Old Town Tequila in San Diego. So that's my dad's store. It's a really famous agave spirit store. He was one of, you know, the early pioneers of adopting agave spirit products. And what I mean by agave spirits is tequila, mezcal, bacanora, ricea. You can book in Sotol onto that too, even though I know technically Sotol is not an agave. But, you know, in the general sense of things, for Americans, it's an agave spirit. But so, yeah, so it's kind of, I was one of those people who was lucky enough to always have access to these things and be able to build up a palate to recognize like good products and like what makes a quality mezcal, like Oaxaca. You know, same thing too with what Alberto's family's always done with their tequila products. And it's just kind of one of those things that it's hard not to love the culture of Mexico, because it is so unique and they have such fantastic, especially like in the food and spirits world. Like, I mean, your Bolazole show, like in all honesty, it's like I didn't have a bad pozole or agave spirit last night when I went around myself and tried anything. I mean, I could pick out like favorites probably, but really like I'm just like, you know, what's that term? Splitting hairs at this point by picking out like what pozole was my favorite. And to speak to that like incredible diversity of culture of Mexico, it's like there was every single pozole I tried at the show is different. And I've done your shows now in Brooklyn and Boston. And it's the same thing with those shows. They're all so different, you know. But what I love about your Bolazole shows is you get that real sense of community. That is also a big part of Mexican culture, where it's like you get that family, you know, like everyone's your friend. And so that's kind of what I think makes the Bolazole shows fun and unique. Why, you know, I'm from San Diego. It's not easy for me to get to Boston and Brooklyn and Denver. You know, it's, you know, I'm in the corner of the country, you know. So it's always one of those things that it's just a magical experience doing these shows. And I love also, too, you know, the hearing how much people love a Matiteña and, you know, the tequila, you know, it's... Who doesn't like to hear, you know, positive things about what you're doing?
Roman, you're great. And I'm going to ask you more questions because you are an important guy in our little club. And now, Alberto, tell us about your family's business. You said it was six generations.
Yeah, I come from a 5 to 6 generation of agave growers. And in the business of tequila, I'm the 3rd generation of master distiller. And yes, it's very fun when we share with all customers, all people, our pleasure of make tequila, share our tradition, the traditional methods like use tajona, use qual fermentation. Everything is fun. I really like that you are making. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to have Roman and Mike are going to ask you questions because They know you well. So Roman, let's talk about when you first met Alberto and his family and some of the steps and ways you had to work together to bring his tequila to the States.
I mean, when I first met Alberto, I wasn't even involved in the industry. You know, I was living in New York. You know, I used to be a social worker. I guess you could call it a territory. We used like different lingo in the social working world, was actually the Union Beer Distributors in Brooklyn. And so, but when I would go back home and visit, my dad would always talk about, you know, the partitas, and I would meet Alberto and stuff like occasionally at events, and I would drink his famous tequila Cava de Oro and a lot of the other products they make. Because even though Alberto and his family primarily, they put their name on products like Cava de Oro and Amatitania, they actually make, he makes a lot of brands. He makes probably about, what, like 23, 25 brands?
I think around 20 to 23, yeah. Around.
And I mean, some of these brands too that even they might not make anymore are some very famous brands that they were the original distillers of. And also too, his family is like credited with being the inventors of the modern style tequilas, which are the ones with those more like rich caramel and chocolatey flavor notes in tequila. So when I moved back to San Diego after, you know, I love New York, but you know, after a while, over 10 years, you could only take so much New York City and the subway. But so after I moved back in, I started really working for my dad, like helping him with his website, oldtowntequila.com. That's when I really got to start knowing Alberto, like by traveling a lot down to Mexico. And I'm lucky because out of San Diego, you can just drive 30 minutes to Tijuana, hop on a quick Volaris flight, and you're in Guadalajara, you know? So it's, that's when I really got to know Alberto, and I really respected Alberto's work ethic, and that he's really one of those people who he wants to make good tequila. You know, that is what he wants to do. He's not one of those ones who's making a brand to just have a brand of tequila because it will make money. Like, no, he's doing it out of the passion, and that's something that I like always. It's one of those things. I like working with people who care about what they're doing versus like, I'm just doing this for the money. I mean, there's plenty of things. If you just want to do something for the money, I mean, might as well just go work in finance, you know, work 60 hours a week, plug in business stuff into a computer. So, you know what I mean? It's.
Oh, that's a great intro. And now Eduardo, you know, like, again, you're one of my original Bozole guys. What's the difference between mezcal and tequila for our listeners?
Oh, okay. This is the question of always, and I think the answer is very easy. Both are fantastic products to come out from the agave, right? Just tequila pick or choose to work with only one agave, that is a blue agave, that is a fantastic agave, so noble, so resilient. But in mezcal, we have the right to work with any agave that we can find sugar in. Actually, in Mexico, we know more than 40 different kinds of agave that we can get sugar out and we can prepare a juice. So when you compare mezcal, you shouldn't compare with tequila. You have to compare with wine. So as each wine, each grape give you a different flavor in a wine, right? A Merlot is not the same than a Pinot Noir, etc. In mezcal, an Espadín, a Madre Cuiche, a Tobalá, a Tepestate, a Javali, they will give you each one a very different flavor. Also, mezcal is made with the tradition of the land that is made, and we have a lot of tradition of mezcal. 100 years ago, maybe less, tequila was called vino de mezcal, right? Because it's a mezcal made in this region of tequila. But right now we have a mezcal that is made in another places in Mexico, and they used to follow the traditions. A tradition to come that far away that maybe before the Spaniards, when we start working with the agave, because the agave was before the humans in our territory. So I think that is the big difference between tequila and mezcal, is just the agaves and the way that we work on them.
So the agaves, they're a plant indigenous to Mexico. They've been there forever.
Yeah, they've been forever. Much, much long time before the humans, for sure.
Now, this is an awkward question, but I have to ask it because so many people ask about, you know, what's the right thing to do? I mean, you guys are Mexican, Mexican Americans, Mexican products, and you're coming to the States. How important it is for you to represent your own brands? How important it is for you guys to be the identity and the leaders on those sales to the U.S.?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. As agave, you know, has been booming over the last few years. I mean, let's think about tequila, first of all. It's growing 20% annually in the United States alone. And then you look at the massive amount of mezcals that are coming in. You know, back in the day, people looked at mezcal as like moonshine. They looked at it almost as like, oh, this is not tequila. It's not high quality. But now people are understanding and they're realizing the quality that's behind it. But everybody wants to get into tequila these days. You've got Kendall Jenner and all these other people that want their own tequilas. But what are they doing to actually preserve the tequilas? What are they actually doing to preserve the mezcals? You know, and we have to understand.
You mean the traditions?
Not just the tradition. I think also the preservation of the agaves overall. You know, there's so many people that are coming in and they're stripping the land and taking all these agaves at very young ages. They're not reforesting, making sure that these agaves are there for longevity. And at this point, I'm talking a lot about mezcal. You know, there's so many wild agaves out there, for example, like jabalí, which I absolutely love. But what are we doing to preserve that? And I think as Latinos, as Mexicans, we need to remember where we came from and respect our products, respect our heritage, and respect the land to make sure that this is not a fad. This is something that could last for thousands of years that people can love and enjoy, but also preserve and persevere.
Alberto, talk about your practices and traditions.
Yeah, same thing. I really respect all things about mezcal, even other spirit from Mexico, like Sotol, Bacanora, and Raicilla. The main thing is respect about the farmers, the agave. I mean, like, every town has his own agave. In Jalisco, we have blue agave, with all of them. Really, I really like the respective tradition and that.
Yeah, so I mean that's the thing that like I love to book it on what kind of everyone was saying, and it's one of the reasons why an earlier question to add on to about like why working with Alberto on a Montetania is it was kind of like he wanted to build this brand on preserving these traditions that are the old world styles, you know, like having everything be single field. You know, honoring the fact that tequila, like Eduardo was saying, is just another type of mezcal that uses blue rubber agave. So it's kind of like that thing, like, it's honoring these old school practices of, you know, doing it responsibly, not making these big, massive batches that you can, you know, cook, crush, distill, ferment, and bottle in 24 hours. And it really is one of those things, like, when you taste these certain products, that like a Matutena, Fortaleza is another one, Don Fulano, like they all, Oaxaca, you know, in Mezcal world, they all are doing it responsibly, like in honoring how these things should be done. And you can taste the difference in where like the terroir matters and you can tell people are doing it responsibly, which I think is important for the longevity of the industry.
And then what was your favorite pozole last night at Bolozole?
Oh man. You know, don't forget, I'm an importer, so there's lots of restaurants, and we want a Montetania to sell around here, so I like them all.
You're just too good.
I actually prefer this pozole from Palenque.
Palenque. Was it the cold one?
Palenque? Palenque restaurant?
Yeah, the cold one. There was the Frio one, yeah.
Oh, that was a good one, too.
I mean, they were all good. I mean, my shoe really liked one of them the best last night. You know, when I got home, I saw, like, my boots were covered in pozole, so. But I really like the ones from Toro, Palenque, Hops Alley, El Chingon. I forget the guy, like, next to us, Fork and Spoon?
Yes, and one was Los Chingones and the other was El Chingon.
El Chingon was really good. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Jim, I would love to add my 5 cents about your question that you asked, because I think it's very, very important what you said. We as Mexicans, American Mexicans, so people that really appreciate the tradition
of our spirit. I've been in a world where the Americans impose their own rules and their own view of our culture. So when the green bottle come in the United States, they come in with their own speech about what is mezcal. They say they have to be 45 ABV, they have to be no barrel, no way that you can put a worm in the bottle. And they was like the Bible of the mezcal, what American people say is mezcal. You know, and they don't have idea about really what is mezcal, but they impose their point of view. So I'm feeling a little bit like the responsibility as a Mexican who carry a brand full of Mexicans, when the money of my brand come back to Mexico, don't go to France or go to other big distribution, right? They are seated in the United States or whatever else in the world. I feel this responsibility to teach, to tell the truth about our mezcals, right? Our mezcal was being barreled since day one. They have worms since day one because the people have the need to distinguish one mezcal to the other to make a little more classy or nice a mezcal than you would serve to your family when they come in your house to visit, right? And so if somebody else put a warning about mezcal, it's not my fault. It's not the fault of the tradition, right? And also, 45 ABV is not true. That is just the 45 ABV is something they imposed in 1990, you know? It's not something that happened in the 19th century, 20th century, 18th century, where the mezcal was between 20 ABV and 40 ABV, right? So, yes, as a Mexican, I think me and all my nationals, we have the chief to teach the truth of our traditions and tell the people that it's not only a business. It's a tradition. It has to be respected as it is.
So tell us also where your most of your either farms or production are located, and then also a little more about these traditions. Like, how long does it take from the time you harvest the agave until it comes in bottles?
Of course. Well, Oaxaca Mezcal is a company that is based in San Dionisio, Ocotepec, Oaxaca, that is 1.5 hours of south of the Oaxaca city, 50 minutes in front of Matatlan, that is the world capital of the mezcal, just for the quantity of they made. We are only single village and so single master distiller. The master distiller is not an employee of the brand. He's partner of the brand. So we went one of the first, if not the first, brands of incorporate as the maker, as a partner of the brand, and not only an employee. So we are single village, single master distiller. We only work with the agaves that grown around us, so we don't bring agaves from far away. We try to be very sustainable. An example of our sustainability is we have an event each year around Earth Day, where we bring volunteers of all around the world and we plant wild agaves. This year I have more than 50 volunteers. They pay their airfares, their housing, and they give me one day of their vacation, so they're staying in Oaxaca to participate in this really nice and green initiative to reforest. So,
how can people get involved in that? How can people get involved in
joining
you?
Oh, just to send me a DM in one of my social media, Oaxaca Mezcal, and Instagram, Facebook, and I would love to find a place for them. If I have a space, but I think I can have a space for any one of your listeners, for sure. So you asked me how long they will take to make mezcal and how much. It's very interesting. Mezcal take around between 10 and 14 kilos to make 1 liter of mezcal, depend of how efficient you are, okay? And they take around 3 weeks to finish one batch to the plant, to the bottle. That is another big point. So when you do the things manually, you lost a lot of juice. Some brands of tequila, they're using diffusers or autoclaves. They can get much more efficient. They can go for maybe 4 or 5 kilos for 1 liter. So that is one of recipe of success economically, right? But it's not the way that we do mezcal. We do it by hand, so we lost a lot of juice for sure. Between what... happening with the wild agaves, et cetera. Yes, we work with wild agaves. We have five agaves that we work with: Madre Cuiche, Tobalá, Espadín. And we have a Juan Jabalí, and a Tempestate. So we have these five agaves, and in these five agaves is everything that we do. We play a lot with Espadín because Espadín is the king. You know, Espadín is what they rule United States, is what we export more, is what we're using for cocktails. And with these Espadins, I do vegan pechugas. I have three vegan pechugas. I know when you see vegan and pechuga, you say, wow, what's happened? It's because pechuga is related to the name of patty, not to the name of chicken breast. So when long time ago we have celebration, they serve turkey breast and the people here pechuga, and they didn't relate it with the plate they have in front, but they related about a special celebration. So they start making a special mezcal they call pechugas. So sometimes you have meat and money for putting meat, but sometimes you only have the botanicals in your house, so using botanicals, or you have a beautiful fruit tree in your backyard, so you're using those. So this is where they come, these vegan pechugas.
I actually have a question about that.
Sure.
Is one time I was told, and while I was in Michoacan, that pechugas, like, is this like, I want, like, is the truth to this? Pechugas were originally created by women for women because they were a softer version of mezcal. Like, once you add the fruits and meat and all that stuff, that's kind of what I was told one time in Pátzcuaro at this, like, tiny little cantina.
Well, I know the pechugas was created for celebration. Now, if it was created for a woman, I will not doubt about it because always the girls are in the kitchen. The women are, they bring the food or the fruit at the table. So I no doubt about it. There was maybe a woman behind that. But what I know is a pechuga is a celebration mezcal. And we need to trade it really nice. But we can drink a lot of that because it's coming from Espadín. So that is good. We need to ask the people to drink a lot of Espadín and just to get the wild agaves for a very, very special occasion, very rarely, because we don't want to finish with this wild agaves. There are problem of they can be extinguished if we keep getting it young, because the people are greedy. They want money, so they kill the agaves young, so they don't allow them to reproduce. They don't get a lot of juice, so they need a lot of those. And after they mix it with Espadín, and they sell it for $70 a liter, so a bottle. So when you see a cheap mezcal, please don't buy it. More if you say they say that is wild agave, because certainly it's mixed with Espadín, and certainly they kill a young agaves. So this is no good. Cheap mezcal is cheap mezcal.
Actually, Alberto, if it's okay with you, can I give everybody who's listening in a little taste of what's going to be coming with the Matetena this by the end of this year? So, well, obviously there's still things that we need to work out, but speaking about pechugas, we will have our own vegan pechuga that will be coming out near the end of this year from Amateteña. And Alberto, if you'd like to kind of just give people a little bit of insight of the fun stuff that we're going to be doing, I think it'd be better to come from you than from me.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, in Amatitan, the place where I born in Zona Valles, you know. We have a specific microclimate, like a
ravine,
yeah, semi-tropical. We have mango, we have tamarindo, and we have plums.
And mamay.
Mamay, yeah. So we are planning to make a special batch of distillation with fruits. And we'll be call it Barrancas, because if you visit Amatitan, it's very popular, visit the Barrancas right there. It's the ravine, and it's the volcano tequila just in front, and the...
Barrancas is just loosely translated to a ravine. So what Alberto is essentially trying to describe is there's these really deep, you know, essentially canyons, you know, right outside the town of Amatitan. Actually, it's really more of halfway between Amatitan and Tequila Town. So it's like the slopes of the volcano come down onto the plateau of the Tequila Valley, then it dips down there. And essentially, this creates a semi-tropical microclimate, because I know you might be thinking like Mexico, Guadalajara, it's so far south. But don't forget, these are really high up in elevation areas. So they're actually not that tropical when you go down there. So because of that, these wild fruits grow. So what Alberto is going to be doing is creating essentially a tequila that's distilled like how Eduardo is doing a vegan pechuga. It can't be called a pechuga because it's a tequila. But so that's why it's going to be a Matatena Barrancas edition. Yeah. And it's going to be rested in everything in Mojones, you know.
Yeah, we're trying to rest it minimum 4 months or 6 months, maybe.
And I mean, Oaxacas are really good. Mezcal does some really good, yeah, like vegan pechugas. Another one yesterday at Bowl of Zole was Danny's Peloton one. That one was really good. That one tasted to me like a holiday ponche. But yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, and it's like we've all been saying all along, like the amount of fun, different things you can do with agave spirits is always kind of like wild. Like, and it's fun.
I can't even taste everything at that event, but even when I just have Danny, so is Leyenda de Mezcal, it's like three or four different regions or types of agaves. And I don't know who knows his stuff really well, but I have the Tobale. Is that last night, and I didn't even know what it was, but I loved it. Does anyone want to tell me about this and that brand? He has, it's four or five different bottles, and whether they're no, from a Leyenda de Mezcal. You want to tell me about it, Rome? Just a quick snapshot.
Yeah, quick snapshot. Like, he uses different regions like Guerrero, Durango, you know, and it's kind of like Eduardo was saying earlier, like agave is similar to wine. Terroir matters, and it really changes like the profile of the spirit where it's grown. And I mean, something that I've found interesting that I've learned over the years is there's even different types of like names for like the same agaves, and it's kind of like, who's right? I mean, for 600 years in Oaxaca, they might have been calling it this, but in Durango, they called it that. So yeah, it's just that's what's really cool about Danny's Gran Leyenda line, is it's highlighting the different regions and the flavor points that can come from those regions.
Okay, last we're going to talk about Amatitania. So Alberto, last night I got to taste what also is great about the event. I got to sit and taste with the maker himself. We tried the silver and also something with some age. Tell me about what you tasted me, okay?
Yeah, we have essentially four products. It's the regular silver. It's 42% alcohol. And we have other silver is still strange. It's 49. That's amazing. The flavor of agave and rustic flavor, earth, minerality, this is really good. And we have Reposado. It's only 2 months in ex-bourbon barrels. And we have Añejo, only rested one year in red wine barrels cask.
Yeah, so all those things, like Amatitania, like I was saying earlier, it's honoring the old school production methods. It's named after the town of Amatitan, which is the first recorded history of vino de mezcal production, which is tequila. It's UNESCO certified and everything. So it's, you know, instead of, it's the agave is cooked in a brick oven, a stone oven, heated by wood fire, tahona crushed, wild fermentation with open wooden tanks, copper pot distilled alembic style. And currently Alberto's the only distiller using all those methods in one brand. You know, so the other brands do use these methods, but not all in conjunction with each other. So it's a really special product, and I hope you guys can all try it soon. It's available in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, the Northeast in general, Massachusetts, Illinois, Colorado, Texas, California, very soon to be Missouri and Kansas and Alaska, which I'm excited about. So it's we're expanding, and it's fun seeing everybody kind of get excited when they're trying, you know, what a really old school tequila tastes like.
And then Mike, just tell us what your role is with this brand in Colorado, and maybe mention a distributor that you're working with. Give us a little local flavor.
Sure, you got it. So, you know, I had already had some connections out here in Colorado,
And when I was talking with Roman and, you know, wanted to discuss future prospects, Colorado was the perfect location for that. I was telling them for a while that while the majority of the country is growing at this point about 20%, Colorado is growing 25%. That's a 5% increase from the rest of the national market right now for agave spirits, predominantly tequila. So I was like, we need to make sure that we get into Colorado. It's a very, very good market. The people here love and breathe tequila, literally. I know that it's a wine country, but or not necessarily wine country, but people love wine here. But again, very similar to wine. You're going into terroir. We've got the fermentation processes. And this is the perfect product for people that are really into tequilas. So when I was, you know, bringing this stuff in, I decided, you know what, let's talk to Momentum. And we started distributing it over here in Colorado. So I've been working very heavily on trying to make sure that Amate Teña grows to the entire Colorado market and reaches as many accounts as possible.
Wow, well, we're actually in, thank you to Sarah and Greg, we're in the brew room of Emporium Brewery in Berkeley region of Denver, and they're starting up some systems. I don't know if it's they're cooking something or they're cleaning, but we're going to make an exit soon. And one more time, that was Mike Montero, the broker and
Mike Moreno.
Sounds like a movie star.
You could find us at Moreno's Liquors.
Thank you. And we'll go around the room. Everyone else will just say again their name and their business, and we'll get out of here.
Thank you again, man. Really nice to be in your program. Very proud. Very happy. Eduardo Belanzaran. I know I have a very difficult name. Mezcaleando on Instagram. Oaxaca Mezcal also. Thank you.
Thank you again. I'm Alberto Partida, master distiller of Amate Teña Tequila. Thank you very much.
And Roman Ramaya, the importer of Amate Teña Tequila. And just really quickly to add on, because I know we're in Momentum, Colorado, also Illinois, Maverick, Texas, Skernick, the Northeast, and Berkshire Brewing, Massachusetts, and Vintegrity in Missouri, Kansas, and California, Skernick.
And we're going to see you all. And hopefully the show's out by then. But if not, you in Boston, April 12th, and back in Brooklyn in October 19th. So thank you guys so much. Thanks to our engineer, Armin Spengen, who's going to clean this up. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time on Heritage Radio Network. Thanks so much, guys. Woo! All right.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.